Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming to our annual results presentation for 2015. No doubt some of you saw our model house in the lobby. Housing is part of our investing for the long term. A couple of bits of housekeeping. Here are the usual forward-looking statements. Please switch off mobiles. And if there is a fire alarm, the home team will shepherd all of you downstairs. This is another terrific set of results from Legal & General. Operating profit up 14%, dividend up 19%, EPS up 11%. I'd like to thank all of my colleagues, and particularly the team in front of me, Mark Zinkler in LGIM, Kerrigan Proctor in LGR, Duncan Finch in insurance, Jackie Noakes in savings, and of course, Gene Gilbertson in LGA. And I missed out Paul Stanworth, but I'll put him in anyway. They're a committed, strategically aligned and ambitious team driving our strategy forward, delivering value for customers and value for shareholders. Today, I will talk about the overall financials and our strategy, and Mark Gregory will lead you through the detailed financials and Solvency II. Mark and his team are central to our success at Legal & General, and I understand completely why he's decided to retire after 18 years and 8 years on our board, plus 3 years as CFO, during which time he landed the S2 internal model approval. But I'm delighted he will be around for some time. Net cash up 14% to $1.3 billion. Operating cash up 11% to $1.2 billion. Operating profit up 14% to $1.5 billion. EPS up 11% to 18.6p, a 17% ROE, and a recommended full-year dividend of 13.4p. That's up 19%. Growth in the teens across our key financial metrics is a major success. We can deliver these results because we have two things: a clear and consistent strategy and the ability to execute well. Our five growth drivers, aging populations, globalized asset markets, the need to create new real assets, welfare reform, and digitalization, these are long-term, persistent, and operate across economic cycles. We are a resilient growth business. We don't just float along passively waiting for the rising tide that lifts all boats. We've positioned ourselves in the fast-moving water. And here's how we've done it. In pension de-risking, we're winning mandates everywhere and becoming a top UK lifetime mortgage provider. We're winning investment management mandates in the UK, in the United States, in Asia. We're achieving further big scheme wins in auto enrollment, moving insurance towards a digital direct model, and investing in long-term real assets to capture illiquidity premium and drive economic growth. The 2015 results are part of a consistent medium-term trend. Over 4 years, our compound annual growth for net cash has been 10%. For EPS, it's been 11%. For DPS, 20%. And ROE has grown to 17.7%. Total shareholder return for 3 years and 5 years has been 114% and 259%, respectively. We've accelerated the evolution of Legal & General from a traditional life office to an integrated asset model: asset gathering, asset management, and asset creation, whilst retaining our market-leading expertise in insurance risk management. We've decluttered and refocused our core capabilities, exited the non-core and subscale, and positioned ourselves in new growth markets, including LDI, real assets, housing, urban regeneration, workplace pensions, and lifetime mortgages, whilst retaining our consistent focus on efficiency and unit cost reduction. We have a compelling vision, and our team is driven by deep thinking and excellent execution. I will return to strategy and outlook later, but first, Mark and I will address Solvency II. Our Solvency II capital surplus at the year-end is $5.5 billion, a coverage ratio of 169%. Our economic capital surplus at year-end is $7.6 billion, a coverage ratio of 230%. The only new business effect for us from Solvency II is in LGR, in the UK, which we had in any case already moved to be more capital efficient and risk efficient business. Please note that about 3/4 of our risk capital arises from market risk, both under Solvency II and economic capital models, reflecting the fact that we are more of an asset company than an insurance company. Solvency II has not materially changed our strategy. Moreover, we believe that there will be further helpful changes to Solvency II as the EU reviews its post-credit crisis legislation, potentially including a reworking of the risk margin for longevity. I'll now hand over to Mark to give you more colour on both on Solvency II and the financial results for 2015.
Thanks, Nigel. I too would like to add my thanks to our colleagues for all the hard work in delivering the business performance in 2015, and also in regard to the implementation of Solvency II, which was a real team effort. I'm very pleased with our results for 2015, but before I get to those, I'll take you through our capital position. As I describe our opening Solvency II balance sheet, I'll also reference our economic capital position, as both are relevant to how we run the business. In aggregate, the group's eligible own funds on both an economic capital and Solvency II basis were the same at 31 December 2015, at £13.5 billion. This is coincidental. They are certainly not bound to be the same number. So for the year-end 2015, it comes down to merely a case of where the line is drawn between what is required capital and what is considered surplus. Solvency II has many similarities to our economic capital. For example, both are calibrated as 1 in 200-year value-at-risk balance sheets. But Solvency II has a number of items which we consider to be non-economic, and hence there are differences between the two, and I'll explain those more later. Our economic capital coverage ratio is 230%, almost unchanged from last year, and our opening Solvency II coverage ratio is 169%, with a Solvency II capital requirement of £8 billion and a surplus of £5.5 billion. Here's a breakdown of our Solvency II capital requirement, or SCR, by risk type, after the effects of diversification. 48% of our £8 billion SCR relates to credit, arising predominantly from our £39.4 billion of bond and bond-like assets backing our annuity business. 11% of the SCR relates to equity asset risk, primarily relating to equities held in shareholder funds, our with-profits fund, and the value in force of our non-profit savings business. Our largest insurance risk is longevity, also equivalent to 11% of SCR on a diversified basis. I should also point out that the SCR includes the SCR related to our with-profits business and our final salary pension schemes. Moving on from our Solvency II capital requirement to consider the quality of the capital resources which contribute to our £13.5 billion of own funds, £11.3 billion of our own funds, or 84% of the total, is core Tier 1, and this component alone covers Solvency capital requirement 1.4 times. Not unsurprisingly, given market risk comprised nearly 3/4 of our Solvency capital requirement, this analysis demonstrates that our coverage ratio is more sensitive to market and economic movements than insurance risks. The sensitivities shown here are all independent stresses to a single risk. In practice, the Solvency II balance sheet will be impacted by a combination of the stresses, and the combined impact can be larger than adding together the impacts of the same stresses in isolation. At a group level, the board has set a preferred Solvency II coverage ratio to be greater than 140%. This is not to say that should the coverage ratio drop below 140%, that any mitigating action will automatically be taken. But it is a prompt to consider whether any action might be appropriate given the prevailing circumstances and what has caused the coverage ratio to drop below 140%. I would remind you that the PRA have been very clear that from their perspective, 100% coverage ratio of the SCR at all times is sufficient. Any buffer above this is at the discretion of regulated firms and their boards. This slide shows a projection of the Solvency II surplus emergence over the next 5 years. It does need some very careful caveats. It is only one projection, and as you saw from the previous slide, the Solvency II balance sheet is sensitive to markets and other insurance experience, as well as to management actions and various other impacts. That said, I still think it is useful to see the trend before these impacts. What it shows is a projection of surplus emerging each year after amortising the transitional benefit, but before the cost of dividend in each discrete year. So, for example, the 2017 surplus emergence is shown before any dividends paid in 2017, but it does assume dividends were paid in 2016, and so on. I can guarantee that in reality, the actual surplus will not emerge as shown here, so don't bother getting your rulers out. But what I am saying is that over time, we expect surplus emergence to be sufficient to fund transitional amortisation, new business investment, dividends, and maintaining a strong capital base as the business grows. When we get to the interims and the next 4-year results, we'll show you the movement in the solvency balance sheet, so we will start to see actual experience rather than a projection. So whilst you have to wait for a Solvency II analysis to change, we can show it now for economic capital. We'll continue to use economic capital going forward alongside Solvency II to ensure the decisions we make are economically robust. We paid £0.7 billion in dividends in the year. In 2015, the new business we wrote generated £0.1 billion of economic capital surplus, and the release from the back book generated £0.8 billion. The other capital movements primarily reflect changes in asset mix and other market movements, as well as some modifications to our model. Economic capital owned funds at year end were £13.5 billion. Our economic capital requirement was £5.9 billion, leading to a surplus of £7.6 billion, which meant our economic capital requirement was covered 2.3 times. Finally, in this capital section, I said I would explain the main differences between our economic capital and Solvency II positions. And this slide shows a bridge between the surpluses on the two bases at year-end 2015. The main difference between our economic capital and Solvency II models is in respect of credit, particularly in the calculation of the matching adjustment, whether that be the assumptions underpinning the matching adjustment calculation or eligibility of either assets or liabilities to qualify for matching adjustment treatment. These differences amount to a not insignificant £1.4 billion. To give you some sense of what a 1 in 200 event looks like, let me describe the longevity stress. We estimate that the average life expectancy of a 65-year-old male in the UK is currently 85.4 years. In addition to this, as you would expect, we also make assumptions about how mortality will improve in the future. Our best estimate adds 1.9 years to give a best estimate life expectancy of 87.3 years in total. Our Solvency II internal model stress then adds a further 3 years to this life expectancy to take it to 90.3 years. So a 3 years increase in life expectancy over the course of the next 12 months. Translate this into causes of death. Our best estimate assumes that 20% of all annuitants who are currently expected to die of cancer will be cured within 15 years. Our Solvency II stress assumes 95% of deaths from all forms of cancer will be cured in the next 15 years. This Solvency II longevity stress goes beyond our economic view of that risk, which accounts for a further £0.3 billion of the difference. Various assets within our balance sheet have been excluded from Solvency II owned funds. On our economic view, these assets amounting to £0.5 billion are included in owned funds. And finally, we don't have a transitional benefit in our economic capital balance sheet, unlike Solvency II, and in this analysis, we've allocated the difference back across various components of the Solvency II technical provisions, most notably to neutralise the difference between the risk margin under Solvency II and the recap cost we hold under economic capital. Moving on from capital to our financial and trading performance in 2015, Nigel has given the top line figures, and I'll now add some colour on the group numbers and cover the divisional performances. Here we have the key numbers in terms of stock of business, cash and earnings, as well as the balance sheet. In terms of the stock of business, there are two particular growth areas to highlight. First, the 8% growth in LGM assets under management, now £746 billion, and driven by almost £38 billion of external net inflows, a record year, and a fantastic performance across all product areas, geographies, and client segments. And the second is a 22% growth in direct investments, now at £7 billion across the group. This growth reflects the success we're having in originating and developing assets on which we expect to enhance the risk-adjusted returns for shareholders. As I said on previous occasions, it is our stock of business which drives our cash generation. Our operational cash at £1,217,000,000 was up 11%. Net cash generation at £1,256,000,000 was up 14%. Operating profit was also up 14%. And our post-tax return on equity increased to 17.7%. Here we see how our business stocks have progressed over the medium term. 11% compound annual growth rate in LGIM's assets under management. LGIM is now the 15th largest global fund manager, but it still represents around only 1% of the global market share, so plenty of headroom to grow. Our insurance premiums have grown by a compound annual growth rate of 8%, now £3.1 billion. And bear in mind, we are the largest player in the UK protection market, with a retail market share of around 25%. And of course, our growing annuity back book in LGR is expected to provide predictable releases for very many years to come. This slide shows the progression in net cash generation during the year, up £152 million, or 14%, with all our business divisions, other than savings, making a meaningful positive contributions to the increase year on year. Moving now to the business divisions, and I'll start with L&G Retirement. This is a growing business, and operational cash generation was up 27% to £372 million in 2015. Net cash generation benefited from a new business surplus of £45 million, within which the longevity reinsurance in respect of new business contributed £55 million post-tax or £69 million pre-tax. An operating profit of £639 million was up by 49% as a result of the expected release from the back book, the new business surplus, higher annuitant mortality in the year, and reserving changes in respect of customers who have gone past their normal retirement date but have not yet chosen to start receiving their pensions. A couple of further points on longevity. Our reserving for mortality improvement is still based on an amended version of the 2013 CMI table, rather than the 2014 table, where the latter places more reliance on recent heavier population mortality. And secondly, we've now reinsured £7.5 billion of longevity risk in respect of our annuity liabilities. Annuity business volumes were lower than 2014 at £2.7 billion, as we did not repeat the two mega deals we wrote in 2014. We did, however, complete over 60 bulk transactions in the UK and expanded internationally with our first Dutch and US transactions in 2015. UK individual annuity premiums of £327 million were lower. The 2014 comparator was £591 million. This was broadly in line with our expectations. However, from a standing start at the end of Q1, we wrote £201 million of lifetime mortgages in 2015. Volumes continued to grow through the year, with £99 million being completed in quarter four. Very definitely a growth business for L&G. Within the total annuity assets of £43.4 billion, we increased direct investments by 20% to £5.5 billion, evidence of the synergy that operates between LGR, LGC and LGIM, something which we will continue, whilst always maintaining discipline over asset quality. Turning to LGIM, 2015 was an outstanding year, but I suspect Zinc would say that the business is only just getting into its stride. Revenues were up by 8% at £694 million, the cost-income ratio was a very competitive 48%, and operating profit from our asset management business was £359 million, up 7%. 2015 saw very strong inflows, and international mandates accounted for £9.5 billion of external net flows. In Asia, LGIM won further mandates in China and new ones in Korea, Japan and Taiwan, and the US business continues to grow strongly, where, as well as having a market-leading LDI proposition, we also won our first multi-billion dollar US index mandate. And we've not neglected the UK. The National Grid pension mandate delivered about £12 billion of inflows. We are expanding workplace savings, which now has £14.7 billion of assets under administration, and continue to win significant new mandates, including John Lewis and Tesco. We believe the latter to be the largest corporate pension scheme in Europe by number of members. Total defined contribution pension assets, including investment only, rose 13% to £46 billion. Our retail offering is also growing. 2015 was a record year for inflows, and we are now ranked at number 6 for retail flows. We were outside the top 20 in 2014. And real assets also perform well, with assets up 26% at £18.3 billion, and LGIM worked closely with LGC and LGR to launch three urban regeneration schemes in the UK, in Salford, Leeds and Cardiff. Legal & General Capital delivered strong net cash, £187 million compared with £162 million in 2014. Operating profit was up 15% at £233 million. LGC has been actively managing and diversifying its portfolio, with a particular focus on direct investments in housing, urban regeneration, clean energy and alternative finance. Direct investments in LGC now amount to £867 million, not just using our balance sheet size and duration to capture illiquidity premium, but also driving synergy gains across the business. For our insurance division, UK protection gross written premiums were up by 2% at £1,442 million in 2015 as a result of strong sales and good retention. Retail protection premiums were up by 5%, with a particular emphasis on growing the direct sales channel, which now accounts for 18% of new business APE. Protection purchases are frequently aligned with mortgages and house buying. Our mortgage club last year facilitated over £46 billion of mortgages, 20% of the entire UK mortgage market. Insurance net cash was up by 6% to £348 million, although operating profit was down to £293 million from £270 million as a result of changes to our modelling of reinsurance for our UK protection business. The impact of these changes was to reduce operating profit after tax by £93 million in 2015, and it will also reshape the prudential margins, deferring some of the emergence of future cash generation. The general insurance business saw operating profit reduced by £8 million in 2015 to £51 million. That includes a £15 million impact from the UK floods in December. The combined operating ratio of our GI business in 2015 was 89%. Compared to 87% in the prior year. Operational cash generation in our savings business was £119 million, down £8 million on the prior year. This reflects the declining contribution from mature savings, which is in runoff, partially offset by the contribution from our platforms business. Lower new business strain meant the net cash generation was only £3 million lower year on year. Savings operating profit was £99 million, as compared to £105 million, reflecting active management of the cost base to offset the lower contribution from mature savings. Covalence remains the largest platform business in the UK, with a 19% market share, and it's now achieved the £11 million cost reduction target set at the time of the acquisition. Legal & General America had a much better year in 2015. Net cash generation, this is their dividends up to group, was up by 9% at $83 million, and operating profit increased from $93 million to $125 million. The 2016 ordinary dividend of $88 million has already been paid. LGA is, moreover, an important component of our expansion in the US. We are using its balance sheet for US bulk purchase annuities, and LGA is also providing back office support to both LGR and LGIM in America. This slide should be familiar to you. It illustrates the consistency and predictability of our cash generation. This means we are able to guide on operational cash generation for LGR, insurance, with the exception of GI, savings, LGA, and LGC. Compared to the £1,014 million we achieved from this subset of divisions in 2015, we are guiding to a 6 to 7% increase in 2016. And finally, on to dividend matters. The full-year recommended dividend for 2015 is 13.4 pence, an increase of 19%. This represents a net cash coverage ratio of 1.58 times, down from 1.65 times in 2014. And as promised, we've also today announced our new dividend policy. Going forwards, we will have a progressive dividend policy reflecting the group's medium-term underlying business growth, including net cash generation and operating earnings. Overall, a great set of results in 2015, with all divisions playing their part, which has enabled the board to recommend a 19% increase in the dividend. And our new progressive dividend policy means we'll be able to reward shareholders for the future growth as we continue to transition our business model towards a greater emphasis on asset gathering. And with that, I'll hand back to Nigel.
Thank you, Mark. Legal & General has evolved rapidly over the last few years. We've decluttered, aligned our strategy to the five macro drivers, set the growth businesses in motion, and are moving successfully towards a more digital asset manager. We've come a long way. 15 years ago, we were a traditional UK life office with a small investment management business. Dull, but worthy. Unsurprisingly, the credit crisis, which took our share price to 21 pence in 2009, was a rude awakening. Since then, we've gone through three phases. From the depths of the credit crisis in 2000 to 2011, we rebooted the company. Focusing on cash enabled us to clean up the business, to set a credible strategy, and to decide what was core and non-core. Net cash grew from £320 million to £846 million, restoring external confidence in the business, but also internal pride. From 2011 to 2015, we delivered consistent progression in cash and dividend. We sold or exited non-core subscale businesses. We focused ourselves on strong markets and geographies and invested in our growth businesses. We took net cash to $1.3 billion with strong growth in EPS, DPS, and ROE. And direct investments started to transform our capital-intensive industries. In the next phase, 2015 to 2025, the focus will be on growing the asset businesses and making our insurance businesses increasingly international and digital. A program that has already started and which will drive our returns throughout the 10-year period. Today, we are substantially an asset gatherer, an asset manager, and an asset originator. The asset businesses, LGIM, LGR, and LGC, collectively delivered operating profits of $1.227 billion in 2015. That's more than three times the £376 million operating profit achieved by insurance in the UK, in the United States, and in Asia. However, expertise and scale in insurance markets is an important component. It is the combination of asset management and insurance risk expertise which gives us a clear leadership position in pension de-risking. We are decluttering and simplifying our businesses to focus on core strengths and growth markets. We closed or sold subscale businesses where we don't have long-term competitive advantage: Egypt, France, the Gulf, Ireland, Suffolk Life, Estate Agency, Ventures, and so on. We reduced costs from $1.25 billion in 2014 to $1.13 billion in 2015, exceeding our £80 million cost reduction target. Kerrigan Proctor's LGR has nine sources of profit, and we're pushing forward on all of them. Optimizing the cash generation of the back book, internationalizing new business with deals now completed in the US and Netherlands, and setting a higher, that's a £500 million target for lifetime mortgages for 2016. As Mark has highlighted, the back book cash generation will remain a source of material profits for many years. A $1.4 billion Lucida transaction in 2013 was a model for back book acquisitions. No people, no systems, and no property. This is a market where further potential as players consolidate or exit is an opportunity for us. LGR's capital light strategy is in place. We've already executed £11.6 billion of longevity reinsurance. We see huge potential demand for pension risk transfer. There are an estimated $9 trillion of DB pension liabilities globally. And there are very few global competitors with the right combination of scale, insurance, and asset management expertise. The asset portfolio backing the annuity books, which we published a few weeks ago, is well diversified and actively managed by an outstanding team with a track record of strong performance. 95% of our flagship active fixed income funds outperformed their benchmarks in 2015. The average credit rating is A-, and a quarter of the portfolio is made up of secured debt. Credit quality and diversification have been strengthened since the credit crunch in 2009. Just 2.9% of the $43 billion is sub-investment grade, and just 4.7% is in oil and gas. We've substantially reduced our exposure to banks In addition, we've built prudent reserves, $2.2 billion for the default risk and $1.7 billion for adverse mortality experience. The direct investment portfolio backing LGR's annuity liabilities is now $5.5 billion and rising. Again, with an average A-minus rating, these raise risk-adjusted returns but also benefit from strong covenants. Our direct investments will continue to grow. We are moving into an age of real assets instead of synthetic assets that fueled the credit crisis. LGIM, led by Mark Zinkler, had a terrific year in 2015 and is really well positioned going forward. Globalization means for us moving towards a three-hub manufacturing model, the UK, the US, and Asia. Distribution is working effectively. Our brand travels brilliantly, and our basic premise of scale, value, and customer service is winning mandates for us even where we have little or no infrastructure. Barriers to entry in local markets are coming down, and we are on our way to becoming genuinely global. We're no longer a monoline asset manager providing index products for UK DB pensions. That was our old model. Our AUM has more than trebled in the last decade, a compound annual growth rate of 14%, and scale has been accompanied by diversification. Here you see the growth across product categories, solutions, fixed income, real assets, workplace pensions, and UK retail, where we are largely invisible for several years, but where we have the benefit of a strong brand and 10 million existing customers. International AUM and flows were strong in 2015. But what I think is really striking here is not the 43% compound annual growth rate, but the amount of headroom for further growth. We are, as Mark mentioned, the 15th largest global asset manager, but our global market share is only around 1%. In my opinion, and indeed that of Mark Zinkler's, our ambition to grow market share towards 2%, a mere 2% over the next decade or so, feels realistic to me. LGC, led by Paul Stanworth, has four areas of focus for direct investments: urban regeneration, housing, alternative finance, and clean energy. We are already leading the way in building an impressive real asset portfolio for the business. These are marketplaces with a clear funding gap where supply and demand are out of balance and where we can deploy our large, long-dated balance sheet effectively, offering partnering with sector specialists. We have momentum, and we're accelerating our delivery, and are always exploring ways to maximize returns, such as our new investment in modular housing, which allows us access to fast, cost-efficient building. This is asset creation for the whole group, and to date, LGC has generated a terrific return on capital by creating assets for LGR and LGIM. This is a simple but important slide, because I don't think we've communicated the multiple drivers of value within LGC well enough. We invest as a principal using shareholder money. We invest as a direct investor to back the annuity book. And we invest as an agent through LGIM and its massive institutional family and friends. The assets we create can be tailored in terms of maturity, in terms of cash flow, in terms of index linking, and so on. And we can choose between LGIM, LGR, and LGC to best deliver our strategy. This delivers economically and socially useful outcomes, but it is also a real win for Legal & General to have this capability. The synergies across LGC, LGR, and LGIM enable us to enhance earnings for shareholders directly, optimize cash flows from the annuity book, and create new asset classes for LGIM and its clients. We have been leading the institutional sector by doing this for 3 years. The political world is now catching up as they realize that investment in real assets is the way to improve productivity and growth. The digital disruption that we've seen across all industries, media, music, retail, and so on, is coming to insurance. We've already seen the effect of regulatory change on intermediate and advised sales in financial services. But the combination of big data, digital communications, and the Internet of Things will have an even bigger effect. Duncan Finch's challenge is to ride that wave. We've made a decent start, but there's a long way still to go. The back office in our insurance business is already highly automated and digital, and delivers competitive unit costs. The drive is now on to expand the front office digital direct channels. Direct customers and sales grew at an impressive rate in 2015, and L&G Direct now accounts for 18% of insurance new business sales. We are investing in the direct channel, in the customer journey, and in experience, in marketing direct and in mobile optimization. This is vital for UK markets and to internationalize in a high-value way. LGIM is a really good digital model, over $1 trillion of AUM, managed by 1,900 employees. Insurance and savings are fast followers. India First, our JV with the Bank of Baroda and Andhra Bank, has been a pathfinder, working closely with the Indian government, which has a strong digital program to deliver basic mass market products to improve financial resilience. We sold 2 million policies in just 3 months. The next steps will be to take that experience and re-import it to the UK, improving financial resilience of our customers by introducing a highly affordable entry-level protection product, which will be a significant disruptor to the UK insurance market. Our aim at L&G is to be our own active disruptor, not a passive disruptee. In savings, we have clear opportunities to add value to the group. We're using more digital to simplify operations, enhance customer journeys, and control costs in the cash-generative legacy businesses, while increasing our scale and hence our operating efficiency in the platform businesses. LGA delivered 6% growth in gross written premiums in 2015. As well as insurance, it gives us a terrific base in the US from which to write pension risk transfer business and to support LGIM America. The US is our second most important market after the UK, and our strategy will mirror what we do in the UK in the United States. We've made good strides there, but we haven't yet maximized our synergies. We are focusing intently on a market that is underpinned by a strong economy and where our brand is really well received. Legal & General is one firm with one set of values and one set of behaviors. We are constantly strengthening the capabilities of our colleagues, building the right positive supportive culture. This is not just for risk management purposes, though culture is the best determinant of compliance, but it's to ensure we attract and motivate the best and most committed people. Our businesses today are focused on those areas where we can operate at industrial scale, providing the best products, service, and best value through tight cost control and economies of scale. The five growth drivers create a world of opportunities for Legal & General over the next decade. Aging populations and rapidly rising populations of over 60s mean that we can aspire to international leadership in pension de-risking. As an asset gatherer, we're operating in a $78 trillion global asset market that is almost borderless and becoming even more global. It is realistic to double our global market share by 2025. We will continue to use our, and I believe them to be unique, synergies to capture illiquidity premium and grow our real asset portfolio. And DC Pension will grow across the world around and over the next decade as it becomes the favored solution in the United States, in Europe, and in Asia. We will leverage our DC and workplace experience to become international leaders in providing private sector solutions for the shrinking welfare states. And we will continue to disrupt ourselves and our markets to drive the digital agenda going forward, not least in insurance, which on a medium or perhaps even short-term view will change beyond recognition. L&G has come a long way in a few years, but it's still very much work in progress. We do take a long-term view, but we've already started to make the changes that will drive us forward over the next 5 and indeed the next 10 years, and we'll make that change positive for our customers, for our employees, and for our shareholders. And I'd like Mark and Mark to join me on stage, and we'll answer questions.
Thank you. Alan Devon from Barclays. A couple of questions. First of all, in 2015, you had strong net inflows into LGIM and the bulk annuity volumes lagged slightly. Can you talk about the pipeline of both businesses into 2016, and particularly on bulks, the UK and the ex-UK pipeline. And then secondly, on LNG capital, which is becoming an increasingly important part of earnings and cash. Can you talk, and you've got some very ambitious targets in housing and regeneration, et cetera. Can you talk about how that plays into in the Solvency II world of the capital-like model? You talk about $1.4 billion in matching adjustment differences. Does that help in the Solvency II world, or is it a headwind? Thanks.
I'll just correct you on it. We have no ambitious targets. I think they're all realistic targets. I do have ambitious targets, but those are not the ones I'm allowed to put on these particular slides. They all got taken out yesterday when I was doing the final verification meeting, sadly. Mark, do you want to take the LGIM? If Kerrigan, if you take LGR, and Paul take LGC, if that's okay, Mark?
Yeah, I think the question is more about book annuities, but yes, within LGIM we had record flows last year really across the board, and we're continuing to see a lot of activity in the LDI space. So obviously with the volatile markets first part of the year and so forth, it's not going to be a straight path, but there's different kinds of hedging activity that will occur and implementing trades on a capital efficient basis and so forth. So we do expect LDI volumes to continue to stay relatively healthy over the course of the year. I'll take a question on annuities.
US and the Netherlands, I think just back to the UK to start with, ever more pension schemes in runoff, more and more schemes closing to future accrual, that market is definitely growing from the, there's about £1.8 trillion worth of liabilities and transferring of the rates somewhere between £10 to £15 billion a year from pension funds to insurers, and I see that growing. The demand is definitely there. I mean, certainly flows will be variable from quarter to quarter. Quite a lot of acceleration towards the end of last year into deals into 2015, but certainly very constructive for the whole of the year this year in terms of the client discussions that we're having.
Thanks. In terms of LGC, I mean, I think the key purpose of LGC is to capture an asset flow that's going to be coming to the institutional investor base anyway, whether it's in Elgin's funds or whether it's in Kerrigan's funds. And, you know, what we're trying to do is capture the kind of value chain earlier on rather than just buy completed assets. It's to build the assets themselves. So the capital that LGC puts in has quite a huge leverage in terms of its ability to capture an asset flow. And Nigel talked about the fact that we can kind of get a 10-to-1 ratio. For every pound we put in LGC, we capture 10 times the asset flow that would go if it's debt-type instruments or, say, in leasebacks to Kerrigan's, and if it's equity-type co-investments, it would go into Marks. And so those benefits all come out in the different divisions. So our targets are very big, but really the catalyst in terms of LGC is to capture that front end of the development process and the deal flow that comes out the back.
A couple of extra points to add. Bill Hughes is not here today. Otherwise, I would have congratulated him. He's cycling 1,400 kilometres to Miffin, and I think he's got 1,300 in his legs at the moment, so he's sat looking a bit weary. But he's done a great job of building our real asset business, and that's gone from about 5 million profit to 50 million profit over the last five or six years. And the direct investment hopper, which is very full at the moment, we've done quite a lot of deals already this year, and so that's tremendous benefit to shareholders. And that combination of Mark's team working with Paul's team, working with Kerrigan's team, gives us a real competitive advantage in winning the bids for that particular area.
Thanks, Gordon Aitken from RBC. Three questions, please. First on annuities, you mentioned the potential for the market to consolidate there. Just wondering if you have any preference between large bulks versus existing retail annuity books versus existing bulk books. And what are the consequences of maybe buying a existing book if the target already has a transitional, do you get the benefit of that under Solvency II? Second one on strain, it's positive overall. And what happens to strain in the new capital-light world when you use longevity reinsurance? And if you can talk maybe a bit about the capacity for longevity reinsurance on an annual basis, that'd be great. And the final point on the matching adjustment, and you pointed out there's a big gap between the capital surplus and the economic capital on a Solvency II basis. Is there anything you can do to reduce that gap and just maybe you can get more matching adjustment on more assets?
If I was going to write some questions, I would have written those questions for us to answer, Gordon. And so thank you for indeed asking those questions. I think just on this big picture stuff around, I'm going to give my colleagues time to think about the answers, so I'm just going to waffle on for a minute. On the whole area of Solvency II, there are sort of four macro themes which we need to think our way through. Is one, the EU is definitely going to change the regime going forward, and that's going to be a benefit to us as they change the risk margin. They've already had three goals of changing the fundamental spread. I think that's point one. The second point is the modelling point that you talked about the difference between matching adjustment. I'll let Mark give you more details on that in the answer. But we didn't optimise. We did lots of things at year end, and Mr. Stedman and Mr. Blunt did a fantastic job, but they didn't quite get everything that we could have possibly done. So there's quite a bit of other things that we didn't get fully modelled out that we would expect in 2016. To model our way through. And the third point, there was a number of optimization things, like ineligible assets. You know, Kerrigan and his team did a good job, but actually there's quite a bit of it that could have also gone into the matching adjustment portfolio if they just speeded up a little bit towards the year end. But they were busy on the 101 other tabs. And the fourth area is really on the whole longevity question that Mark talked about, where we've stood back and we've only used the 2013 table. At some point, we've got to look at all the data that's coming through where people have just been dying. A lot quicker. But if Kerrigan, do you want to go through the first answer, Mark, and you want to take point of the second?
Just on the industry consolidation, I mean, clearly there are some interesting opportunities out there. I mean, we'll look at them just like any other deals. We'll look at our return on capital metrics. We'll look at impact on coverage ratio. We'll look at the impact on our cash metrics. But certainly some interesting deals out there. I mean, broadly, they rely on the same skills as bulk. You need administration, you need asset management skill sets, and you need to understand the longevity risk. On the individual side, of course, we've got 550,000 individual policyholders ourselves, so we do understand that longevity risk, and we'll pick between the best bulk back book deals or the best individual annuity back book deals or the best front book deals. On your point about transitionals, yes, if you're heading towards Part 7 on those deals, then I think you're pretty likely to get transitional relief, so that's a possible additional boost for looking at some of those back books. So interesting, certainly, to look at.
Well, there's plenty to look at the moment. I mean, we're not short of opportunities to look at, and there's not lots of competition around for those things.
You talked about capacity for longevity reinsurance. I was at a global conference on longevity reinsurance last year, and there are lots of global reinsurers either interested in the market as an offset to mortality risk or interested in the market because it's such a potential for growth in the market or interested to do longevity risk alongside asset risk, but a huge global interest and understanding in the UK market. So you're really positive on capacity there over the next, over the foreseeable future.
Okay. Just a couple. So we put on the impact on surplus. I think we've explained it as best we could at the half year, Gordon, that you know, the effect of the capital strategy is broad is to bring more of the profits forward. There's less profits in the tail from the capital strategy, but the reinsurance typically and brings more into new business surplus. So hence in my speech, I gave you a number for the benefit to new business surplus in 2015 based on the reinsurance we entered into the longevity in the year. So I think that feature you should expect to continue broadly going forwards. On your other question around what scope is the closest gap in the 1.4 billion I highlighted between the economic capital surplus and the S2 surplus in respect of national adjustment treatment, I think the answer is some and some. Some of the differences I think are permanent in nature. So, for example, Solvency II is very clear that any assets below investment grade, you can't take any yield enhancement below that grade, and below that is deemed to be credit risk rather than any liquidity. So you are forced to go back up to a BBB yield. So those sorts of features, they are permanent features going forward. So we wouldn't expect those to reverse. But I think there is some scope elsewhere in the difference between the UC treatment of MA and Solvency II. For example, some of the liabilities we have on the annuity side currently don't qualify for MA treatment, and some of those we think with some renegotiation with the counterparty or indeed some more work ourselves and just taking the PRA through our thinking, we hope we can get more of those liabilities to qualify for MA. So as a guide over the next year or two, I might hope for maybe a quarter or a third of that gap to close. But we will need a lot of work to do internally, and then we've got to take our colleagues at the PRA through our thinking as well. So that's certainly kind of our target, what we'd like to try and achieve.
That's hundreds of millions of gains, not tens of millions of gains. Just working. Greg, I know you're surprised. We usually wait till the 17th question before we ask you, because it usually comes in eight parts. And
your eyes wandering and waiting. Yeah, right. Just in terms of the bulk annuities, I mean, they shrunk by 60% this year, and you took reinsurance, so there's obviously a capital constraint of some sort. You've given a forecast on Solvency II. I wonder if you could give us a feel for what, and it's got a new business strain in, I wonder if you could give us a feel what the bulk and the UK protection budget is in that forecast thing you gave. Second thing is platforms. I wonder if you can just give me the contribution to the NCG of the platform business. I think it's a loss of some sort. Just trying to think if you sell it, what the boost to NCG will be. And the third question is, I wonder if you can give us a feel, because, I mean, obviously credit risk has been a theme that's been quite dominant this year, in terms of how many, what sort of billions of bonds you had downgrades on this year versus what billions you had upgrades. So we can just get a feel for sort of activity that's going on in your portfolio.
Okay, I get all those.
What?
I get all those.
I think that Carrie can take the first, you can take the second and third. I think the volumes, we're not capital constrained, I think is the point. I think we were resource constrained to getting through all of the Solvency II work.
When I look at 2.7 billion bolts roughly compared to 5.9 billion bolts in 2015, in 2014, clearly in 2014 we did the big ICI scheme, 3 billion, TRW scheme, 2.5 billion, that made a big difference. We closed roughly the same number of policies, and I think what I really focus on is return on capital metrics and profitability, and I'm not fussed about the fluff in the middle, but that's the volume figure. And that's very much how we think about the business, and we think very constructively, as I said, about the business in the UK, in the US, and the Netherlands, competitive dynamics looking good in those markets for us.
Broadly in line with the volumes we wrote in 2015, although it obviously will hinge a lot, Greg, on exactly the pricing and the actual risk characteristics, but I think in simple terms of your thinking, it's broadly in line with the 2015 volumes.
So it's 3 to 4 rather than the 6 to 7. Billion.
Okay, then the other two questions. So on the net cash contribution from platforms, it is positive, but not very positive, Greg. So to correct your question, it's not negative, but not a stunningly positive number either, but there is a small positive contribution from the platform net cash generation. In terms of your question around credit experience in 2015, we had £2.1 billion of downgrades across the whole of our shareholder funds and annuity bond portfolio, so about 5% of the portfolio was downgraded in 2015, and we had about £0.5 billion of upgrades during the year as well.
Hi, it's Anasia here from Jefferies. The first question was just on the Solvency II ratio. Spreads were obviously volatile so far this year. Are you able to give us any Solvency II number at the peak of the spread widening so far this year and where it is now, just to understand the range within which it moved? The second question, again, on Solvency II. You've given us quite a lot of useful sensitivities, but are you able to give us anything on a scenario like a 2008 financial crisis? And the last question is just to follow up on the longevity reinsurance. We've had comments from the PRA increasingly cautious about longevity reinsurance. Do you have a comment on what that means for the future of your strategy?
Yeah, just on the movements, when I talked about Solvency II, there are going to be four big themes this year. One is the EU theme, which is going to result in hundreds of millions of difference. The modelling changes, hundreds of millions of difference. The back book optimisation, and hundreds of millions of difference. So there's quite a lot of modelling stuff, which I think is preferential for us going forward for Solvency II. The big picture thing about Solvency II, I don't think it makes any material difference to our business whatsoever for this year. The strategy that we had for last year will just be totally replicated for this year.
You can have the number. I'm not ashamed to give it. So it's 1.58% at the middle of February, and it's about 1.63% as of the end of last week. Again? So that's the coverage ratio. I've asked the question, what was the coverage ratio at the middle of, at the peak of the spread widening in February? It's around 1.58%. and it's about 1.63% at the end of last week. And your question around kind of, you know, stresses rather than scenarios, clearly we give an individual stress at a minute point in my presentation there that clearly these things do happen in combination. All I would say, we're not going to give the scenarios today, but clearly we had to make sure we did our 1 in 200 stress, etc. All the kind of known lifetime events had been covered by, they had been caught within the 1 in 200. So things like, you know, that the events of 2008 had to make sure they were within our view of 1 in 200. We couldn't have that as being beyond 1 in 200. So I would say that in the round, our view of 1 in 200 absorbed all known events in the last 100 years or so. So clearly that was just to make sure that our 1 in 200 wasn't kind of too tight.
Just do two here and then move over there.
Yeah, hi, Ashok Musadi from JP Morgan. Just a couple of questions. Going back to the Solvency II point, if I start with 1.158 at February lows, if we strip off the dividend, which should have been paid with last year's earnings, so you're like 150%, give or take. Your target is 140%. We didn't enter a kind of big crisis. February was nowhere close to 2011. 2008 was like wide away. So how should we think about the dividend growth, given that your buffer at such a, like, February lows was 10 percentage points, or say, how should we think about 140%? What does that mean?
Okay.
So that's one.
Yeah, I'll take that one.
The one thing I can rest assured, we'll do better than your forecast. I think I was just looking through the history of JP Morgan's forecast on our dividend, and bottom of the class would be best on that. I think the... Rest in KBW. Okay, you're in the same range, but actually, believe it or not, Greg, you've been better than JP Morgan on that. I think going back to the first point is that Solvency II is in its early stages. There's a number of EU things that are going to get rolled out. We're going to get the ineligible assets changed at some point during the course of the year. There's some optimization of getting stuff that's one grade up a notch from triple B to single A minus. And there's a lot of potential to do stuff with the portfolio. 140 is simply, it's not a target range in the sense that we even have to take any action. It's still a huge buffer at 140. It's not a range that we wanted to give an illustration of what the board would ask us as a management to begin to think about any management actions. And, you know, clearly we're not in any type of scenario like that. We've got another question.
That's clear. Second question is, how should we think about annuity growth and earnings? I mean, what I was looking at is your net inflows in 2014 was $4.4 billion. So versus opening AUM, say 12% net inflows or growth in assets in 2014, whereas your earnings jumped by 27% in annuities in terms of operational cash generation. That's a big jump between asset and earnings. Similarly, this year, your net inflows in annuities is like $0.4 billion, which is like 1% of the asset base. So how should we think about this asset growth versus earnings growth?
I think Carrigan gave a great answer to that, but I don't know whether you picked it up, is that we actually can grow the profitability and the cash from the business just by doing relatively what I would regard as simple optimizations. So my colleagues tell me they're very onerous optimizations. So we're, you know, very, very confident that the op cash that comes off the annuity book in 2016 will be significantly ahead of the op cash that we had in 2015. And then it's up to Kerrigan and the team to come up with various non-back book optimizations to drive the earnings further forward in 2016. There is a bigger choice and a bigger funnel, if you like, to look at, because we've got a lot of back books in the UK which are coming on the market, and the team are looking at those. We've got a lot of UK deals which are on the market. I'm not sure we're going to usually try and get one clause for the Morgan Stanley conference, but we'll have to see whether we do that later this week or not. But if it's not this week, it'll be shortly thereafter. The clients aren't always as obliging as we'd like them to be. Kerrigan was in America last week, and indeed, you know, the Dutch market and the Irish market are further opportunities for us. So we're spoilt for opportunities, and there's 9 sources of profit that we had down. A few years ago were 2. Mm-hmm. We've gone from 2 to 9, and very comfortable. Anything you want to add to that, Kerrigan? Yeah. Okay. rewind, go to the front, and then work your way back.
Morning, it's Abid Hussain from SocGen. Three questions, if I can. If I can just quickly come back to the 140% ratio that you mentioned, I was just wondering, at what point would you stop paying dividends? And I appreciate the EU looking at redefining the risk margin definition. That's the first question. And then the second one, if you were at the same level of bulks as you did last year, how much Solvency II capital would you consume going forward? If you could give us some sense on that. And then finally on margins, can you share your EEV new business margins on UK bulks versus US bulks?
Yeah. Those are the good questions. Those are not the good questions, but I'll answer them anyway. I don't see at the moment, there isn't a 140 is not a dividend trigger by any means whatsoever. It's net cash and earnings. If you read the dividend policy, it doesn't say anything about Solvency II in there, whereas it used to. If you go back and read last year. So we have changed. There's such a lot of headroom in Solvency II. And I think as Kerrigan was trying to explain, there are four or five things which are going to happen this year which will help free up the amount of cash that we generate in capital that we generate as a business.
I think just on the margins point, we haven't given the breakdown of the figures, but the UK bulk would have been ahead of the US just because of the nature of the business. UK is typically inflation linked, and there were some deferreds in there. The big US deal was no COLAs and all pensioners.
Yeah, just on your point about the impact of capital in Solvency II, in the projection slide I showed you, there is a new business strain number on there. Clearly, that's a combination of all the groups of new business, not just, it's not going to be a granular breakdown by business line, but we have an indication there of how the total business we expect to write will come through in a Solvency II strain perspective. So the slide I gave you has to give you an indication of how we think about that impact going forwards.
Okay. Oliver Danandi. Okay. Is that okay?
Oliver Steele, Deutsche Bank. Apologies, I'm going to ask about Solvency II again, at least two of the questions. The first is you've done the opposite of Aviva and Pru in the way you've stated your Solvency II ratio, so I wonder if you could just give us an alternative Solvency II ratio if you strip out the with-profits fund and the pension fund surplus. Secondly, can I come back to that slide 14 about the new business strain, because it looks very low, and you say it's a sort of mixture of everything. So I wonder if you can just give us a little bit more guidance on exactly what's gone into that. I assume it's something to do with the sort of protection in force generation and that sort of thing. And then thirdly, you talk about consolidation of pension pots. Are you talking organically funded consolidation of pension pots?
What would
or
be
annuity pots, rather.
What would be non-organic?
Issuing shares.
Well, I think this is it. No, I think we feel maybe we're not getting across very capital hit strong, and so the amount of capital that we're using in the business is not that great. Hence, you know, the surpluses were incredibly strong. So this view that somehow we're capital constrained or capital constrained in 2015. Isn't true whatsoever. Do you want to pick up the other?
Yeah. So on the SCR impacts, with profits, about £650 million of SCR in our calculations. Of the £8 billion, about £650 million represents with profits SCR. We've got about £80 million in respect of our two internal defined benefit pension schemes. I'll let you do the maths. Not that difficult, Oliver. In terms of extra color, just back to the slide there, I guess the one thing I would say is that almost inevitably in Solvency II round, we're going to see annuities being Solvency II strained in pretty much all of the new business we expect to be surplus generating on Solvency II, partly to do with diversification benefits, etc. But probably as a rule of thumb, annuities will strain, and the likes of Duncan's World in Protection will look quite attractive given the natural diversification between the two business lines. No, pretty much all lines actually diversify against annuities.
Andy? Hi, thanks so much. Andy Hughes from Macquarie. Three questions if I could. The first one is, I thought we'd better talk about your dividend forecasts, given that ours are rubbish. On slide number 13, going back to Solvency II progression,
clearly we can see, I just want to double check exactly what I'm looking at here. So the big bars, are they pre or post the new business strain? Do they include Elgin? So if I'm looking at the kind of progression of the net of the two bars, is that how I should think about the dividend?
Yes.
And
yes.
It doesn't seem to be growing at 5 to 6% or 19% in future. In fact, it looks like it's growing at a very modest rate. So is the dividend growth in future coming from the one-off management actions you've highlighted in terms of risk margin, matching premium, or should we expect a much more moderate rate of dividend growth in future, I guess, looking at the projection you've got here?
That projection's not, it's to show there's plenty of dividend headroom, because some of you asked for that slide. Mm. If you read the dividend policy, it doesn't mention that, Andy, I don't really notice. It didn't say net surplus generation, it says earnings and cash. So we'll be basing the dividend going forward on earnings and cash, not that. That was mainly for the techies, so that you understood that this, because a number of you were anxious that that was going down, so we wanted to produce a slide.
Sure, but this is the cash, isn't it? This is the Solvency II surplus, so this is the cash.
But that's
generation.
Not the cash that we're going to be using for the dividend policy. The dividend policy is driven off earnings and net cash under IFRS.
Right, okay. I'm not sure I understand the distinction. But the second question was on the CMI 15 table. Which shows up a couple of questions, really. Obviously, it's materially lower than 14 and 13 that you're currently using. So how long is it before you sort of adopt CMI 15? And if you don't, and your view is more that you should stick with 13, doesn't that mean you'll have lost less new business coming through over the next year as other people sort of think, well, CMI 15 may be the way to go?
Well, as you know, Andy, we use a modified version of CMI 13. Despite higher mortality, we were reluctant to move with that trend in last year. But we do expect a full review of that longer-term trend this year, something we'll be looking at. I mean, of course, there's a distinction between reserving and what we use for pricing also, so I don't necessarily think through what we put in reserving. It just controls how much we release each year versus up front rather than how we think about how we price the deals.
Yeah.
Just a bit more color on the question about the surplus projection. I should try to say my explanation. Actually, each year, assume the prior year dividend has been paid. So we have got a progressive dividend assumption baked into that calculation. So when you're looking at just the increase in the top line, actually, you're losing the fact that actually there's already a progressive dividend being paid in all prior years. So it's a little bit misleading to think about just the growth on that chart in isolation. Inherently, the projections for all prior years allow for progressive dividend to be paid. I won't give you the exact number, but we have a progressive dividend assumed in our plan. Well, there's lots of other moving parts as well, Andy. I think that's still not technically correct the way the projections work. So each prior year has already got a progressive dividend paid in, so you've already taken the paying that progressive dividend. So just looking at the top line growth doesn't show you the complete picture.
I think this is the last question, unless anybody else wants to put their hands up, but I'll do a wrap-up afterwards.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Andrew. Yeah. Well, two more questions.
Hey, good morning. It's Sahaj Chingazi from Nomura. I suppose, just for clarity or comfort, could you just give us your quick pitch for the change in dividend policy when you went to the board? So we're changing from cash cover to this. What was that? Second thing is, I suppose, can you also do something in terms of optimizing your balance sheet, given that you have a core tier one, which is strong. And the final thing is just a point of clarity. You don't give a top end of the range. You just give 140. Will you be waiting to get the new EU stuff coming through and then sort of decide on that later? Thanks.
Yeah, I'll pick all those up. I mean, clearly we've had two sources of dividend growth over the last 5 or 6 years, a combination of both business growth and a structural reduction in the net cash coverage. Clearly, the new policy is quite clearly not got that linkage to reduction in cash coverage in there. So we're very clear going forward. You should think about dividend growth very much in the context of the underlying business growth you expect the organisation to achieve going forward. We're not going to be formulaic about it. We're simply saying that the structural decline reduction in the cash coverage has been now being removed from the dividend. So you should expect the dividend to be much more correlated to underlying business growth from this point forwards. In terms of the wider kind of sources of capital in our balance sheet, we're always looking to make sure we've got an efficient capital balance sheet. We have about 30% leverage operating leverage currently in our balance sheet. Now we have a double A minus credit rating for both Moody's and S&P for our insurance business, Airgas, and that's important in the context of the covenant we can offer for annuities, etc. So we can always look at kind of the efficiency, and we probably could take out some more debt without threatening that rating. It's something we keep on active review rather than something we can hit the button on in 2016. But we make sure we have got the right balance between debt and equity. And in terms of that, not having a top end of the range, I think clearly that's a deliberate policy at this stage. I think we want to live in the Solvency II world for a while longer to make sure kind of what we think has been too much. I mean, we would expect to be able to deploy capital, and Nigel outlined a lot of growth opportunities going forward. So we want to make sure we have enough firepower to deliver against that whilst maintaining a strong capital base. I think we're just holding back for now, trying to think through what might be too much capital.
Andrew. And Gordon, you're the last question now. Okay.
It's Andrew Crean here at Autonomous. Could I ask a couple of things? Firstly, the risk margin, erroneous calculation of the risk margin. Could you talk a bit about the possibility that the regulator will be able to get things changed and over what time frame with the EU and what that would do for you? And secondly, could you talk a bit more expansively on your retail savings strategy in the UK? Because your adherence to platforms doesn't seem to be that strong if you read the press. You've closed the with-profit funds and that sort of thing. I mean, what is your preferred route to market in retail savings, or are you just sort of saying that that area of the market is not one which you want to emphasize?
Okay, I'll answer the first, and Mark, you can answer the second. It's Andy taking the last question. I've got put my glasses back on now, so at the line of sight. In terms of the whole issue around Europe, we had various discussions with Europe towards the end of last year. I'm very sympathetic, you know, with Gabriel and various other people who recognize that it's an imperfect rule that was designed in 2009 when the longevity market didn't really exist for longevity reinsurance market didn't really exist. There are two or three different routes to getting it sorted out, one which would conclude in 2017 and two that would conclude in 2018. But there'll be various representations made by the industry. I think Treasury's already made its views pretty clear that they would like to see it change. It doesn't make a huge amount of sense for UK PLC to reinsure a lot of this stuff offshore and the tax revenue and the expertise get moved to different jurisdictions. So there's a sympathetic understanding by both the regulators, by Europe, and by the Treasury. And whether that's, I'd prefer to see it get resolved in 2017. My many, many years of dealing with Brussels say that 2018 is more likely, but certainly the quality of the meetings that John Godfrey and Ted Hart had with myself in Europe were very high. On retail savings, do you want Mark to answer, Mark Dizzy to answer, talk about retail?
Yeah, in regards to LGIM, so we did have a very good year last year in retail sales. So the unit trust business moved across to LGIM a couple of years ago. We've always ranked around 12th, 13th, 14th in this market, since we've had such an institutional focus. So we have rationalized our product offering and pricing and so forth. And as you heard earlier, we had net sales of that ranked sixth in the country. So it's the highest ranking we've ever had by a wide margin. And we do expect to continue to grow our market share in the retail market, doing well in passive, as you'd expect, but also in multi-asset and property. And we have this outstanding fixed income team that we've really never adequately marketed into the retail market. So that's obviously going to get a lot of focus since we do very well in the institutional space.
One last question from Andy.
Thanks, Nigel. Andy Sinclair from BofA Merrill Lynch. Just three quick questions. Firstly, on annuity pricing, since Solvency II has come into force, I just wanted to get an idea if annuity pricing for bulks has materially changed, if there's any material impact at all on return on capital employed. Secondly, just possibly wrapping up a number of comments that have been, or points that have been raised about Solvency II, just wondered if you could give us an idea of how many points of capital you'd be organically generating, all things being equal, after the dividend has been paid each year. And thirdly, just on lifetime mortgages, clearly looking for a lot more growth there. I believe you don't get the matching adjustment for these at the moment. Just wanted to see what could be done there and what the opportunity is as you continue to grow.
Okay. Do you want to talk about bulk pricing?
So on bulk pricing, the capital-light model under Solvency II, I mean, we're seeing three things. Firstly, the increasing benefit of using longevity insurance, as we talked about. On the asset side, it favors some mix of high-quality global investment grade, self-manufactured DI and gilt, so that's the other element to it. And then probably the third element, the prices have gone up a little bit for the end purchaser. So we're seeing a combination of all those things. If you did nothing, the price increase would have to be higher to maintain the return on capital, but that's why you have to work and do the hard yards to get the structuring right.
Mark, can you take the second one?
Yeah, I can't ask you a question precisely, Andy, because if I do that, you better back solve what we think the dividend increase is going to be going forward, given my slides. So
I stick
to what I said in the script. Actually, we expect to produce enough surplus each year to fund the transitional amortization, to fund new business growth, to pay a progressive dividend, and to retain sufficient to grow the capital base as the business grows. So you should take from that that there's enough money going around to feed all the mouths you'd expect to feed.
On lifetime mortgages, you're right, we took no credit in 2015, and that's one of the optimizations for 2016 is how we restructure the lifetime mortgage business so it does fit in and become matching adjustment compliant, because we had what we thought was plenty of headroom, so we didn't. It's one of the many projects that Mr. Stedman, Mr. Hickman, Mr. Blunt, and various others of my very clever colleagues have got on their list of to-do list for 2016. I think, in summary, we're feeling very good about the results for 2015. Over the last few years, we've constantly outperformed the industry's expectations, particularly on dividend. There's a very famous slide which Merrill Lynch kindly produced called the Worm Slide, which those of you who haven't got it, we'll kindly make it available on our website for you. And we are feeling confident about the future. The range of opportunities and growth opportunities are so much better than they were four years ago. Got a much more capable, very focused management team. It isn't just the people in the room today, it's the bench strength that exists right across our organization. We have a fine risk function led by Simon Gadd that really keeps us all on our toes. And sadly, he knows so much about the business and how it all works that there's nothing gets past him in any of the meetings that we have. We'd really like to thank everybody for their support over the last years and some of the constructive criticism we've had over the last few years. We'll relentlessly try and drive the earnings forward, the dividends forward, and continue to improve our ROE. So thank you.